Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Oh, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
The Middleman, Disc 3. Our plan is sheer elegance in its simplicity.
I'm Sean.
I'm Mike.
I'm Julia.
And we are here to finish off the last episodes ever made of The Middleman.
Sad.
Super sad.
I feel like we need a moment of silence for the show. It is gone forever. We'll never get to do another episode about it.
Though I will mention that there are two comic books that are in the same continuity, which were made afterward, that folks should look up on o2stk.com.
Yeah, there's also a read-through at Comic-Con that you can find a video of with some of the actual cast
of the lost
next
episode.
Yeah.
And then there's one of the episode that would come out after that, which they, I guess, crowdfunded and then did a public performance of, which is also on the YouTubes. So there are ways to get more Middleman joy. But it is... This is it, y'all. This is the last of them. So I think we should just dive in and just do this.
Yep.
Let's do it. So let's start with episode number 9 called The Obsolescent Cryogenic Meltdown, which stars... Or co-stars, I guess, a very, very buff Kevin Sorbo, which was surprising to me because I was not expecting Hercules to show up. But then he was there. So, yay. I thought it was a really fun episode. And I guess we should start by actually having somebody describe what this episode's about. And Mike... Since you were originally the one that brought the Middleman to us, we're going to start with you, but then we're also going to end with you.
I think, yeah, isn't this one of your favorites?
This is,
it
like
is totally
his
one of
show.
My favorites.
No, I mean, this particular episode, I think I remember Mike saying was one of his very favorites.
Yes,
whereas
because...
the next episode is one of my very favorites.
Oh,
great.
Cool. Well, Mike, why don't you describe the basic idea of episode 9 for the listener?
Yeah, so in this episode, there is a rash of crimes involving melting, and the middleman, the senior current middleman, does lots of research, and they're diving through the middle lore, which is all of the documentation by middlemen, to try and figure out who this is. And they discover it's The Candle, who is a 1960s-era middleman villain. And when Ida hears that they're being faced with The Candle, she defrosts the middleman from the 1960s, who is played by Kevin Sorbo. Then you get 1969 middleman, 69 as he is called, to be able to differentiate between current and previous middleman. And the current middleman start having kind of methodological disagreements, because middleman 69 is very much like 60s era James Bond in a few ways, and the current middleman is way more kind of... chivalrous and square-jawed do-gooder type. So they're going back and forth, and the other main plot for the episode is Wendy's relationship with Tyler Ford, as they go on a date to the amazing Waffle House, the Batter of the Bulge, which is just filled with glorious puns. And then they play a super awesome video game, and then kind of the B-plot of that episode is their relationship threaded throughout, and Wendy thinking that she's worried because all of her relationships, she's known how they're going to end, and this one she doesn't. And then these two plots play off of each other in really cool ways. And spoiler wagon approaching! To spoil the episode, It turns out that Middleman 69 manufactures a crisis in order to try to eliminate the current middleman, and kind of falls into the supervillain cliches and tropes that he and the team had been identifying throughout the episode. So the urtext for this one is very much classic James Bond films, and then things that flow out from there.
Yeah, and the thing that I loved about this is, this is the thing that this show just does, which is there are so many references everywhere at any one time, and I know I'm missing references, but when I started picking up references from this, and I was like, okay, I have to Google to make sure I'm right, like the when Wendy plays the Contessa di Contini from The Protectors, and Guy Goddard slash Kevin Sorbo, who his friends call him God, and he plays the guy from the same show from The Protectors, but they take the names, and then there's that whole room is like other characters from other sort of like spy shows in that same vein, right? So this whole episode is just a giant like reference bin for every single spy thriller, you know, major franchise from that period, and it's so much fun, and I feel like any nerd, like super geek nerd who like knows any like niche market could like take one episode and would just like have like the greatest time of their life just noticing all of the references. There's just so many.
Yep, I heard it much.
It's fun. Kevin Sorbo's character is also kind of fun, despite the fact that he's a horrible human being. But there's almost something charming about him, and yet also super sleazy. I don't know why. It's sort of a collection of opposites that I don't know. I don't know. Do you have a take on Kevin Sorbo's character, either of you?
I mean, I think he is very much doing the classic misogynistic James Bond character. And the other obvious call out that this particular episode makes is to Austin Powers, because he is cryogenically frozen and then brought back from the 60s, which is exactly the plot of Austin Powers. And in Austin Powers, there is a lot of sort of like nudge, nudge, wink, wink. In the 60s, people were allowed to be politically incorrect. But it's kind of like funny. But this, I appreciated the fact that Wendy Watson is just like, this is sexual harassment and this needs to stop. And there's no point at which she thinks it's charming. She's just like, he's staring at me in a pervy way, isn't he? And that's not actually funny. Which I appreciated quite a bit. And I appreciated the fact that, like, this ultimately made him not actually seem like a role model and a hero.
Yeah, because the middleman that we've grown to know is really kind of a throwback in some ways that he approaches the world. You know, he's a big fan of Westerns, and he has the Eisenhower jacket, and yet he's substantially more feminist along a number of axes, from what I could see and the way I interpreted it, than Middleman 69. And that dialogue between those two perspectives and Wendy's reaction to Middleman 69 also plays out in the kind of sexual politics of her relationship with Tyler throughout the episode, in terms of the way that their relationship develops and whether, you know, are middlemen allowed to love?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. However, the episode does actually take its chance to make Wendy wear a cat suit and go pretend to be a high-stakes gambler. So,
which was fun. Yeah,
but then at the end of the episode, she gets to pick her own uniform.
Right, which is kind of one of the elements here, right? That she's always assumed she had to pick this, that she had to wear this rather stuffy uniform. And then, of course, it's Kevin Sorbo's Guy Goddard slash God, who kind of reveals, like, no, she's allowed to wear whatever he wants. It just so happens that he's bringing that up because what he wants her to wear is what she does eventually wear at one point, which is basically like a bikini. And gets to play for like a very brief moment, like the Bond girl, like coming out of the water, but very much like upset with that. Like it's not seductive in the way that we expect of a Bond girl, right? Because like we have that famous image, right, of I forget which one it is, where she's coming out of the ocean and it just sits there as she like slow motion walks with that really romantic music in the background. We never get that. We get her going, I can't believe this is what's going on right now, and just like kind of stomping away from the scene and then it's over, which I really did appreciate. Kind of, it's obvious that that's what they're playing on, but then also kind of just undermining it as the kind of ridiculous farce that that kind of thing really is. It's just kind of fun. And I did like that, that Guy Goddard did, as you kind of were pointing out, Micah, he plays a very obvious foil to the middleman. I mean, he is from this older time too, or at least in terms of his personality, but he is kind of like all the bad elements of it kind of embodied in one person, whereas the middleman we have may be quaint and kind of old-fashioned, but his old-fashionedness is still kind of progressive, which is kind of the complete opposite of what we get from Guy Goddard slash God. So, it's fun.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting... I agree with Mike that the modern middleman is a much more feminist kind of guy, even though he is also much more conservative and straight-laced in his personal morals and the way he feels that he should behave. So it kind of, you get the interplay of the guy from the 60s being looser and supposedly more fun. But then when you look at what they actually both truly want and believe in their hearts, I'm always going to rather spend time with the guy from now.
Yeah.
Because he's going to respect me as a person. Whereas 69 middleman is definitely not going to respect me as a person.
Right. Well, very clearly, right? Because he basically leers at her the first time he comes out. And
all women. Like, there's the point when he goes over to her house and he basically seduces Lacey. And that part is a little bit troubling to me, honestly, because Lacey is usually a better character than that. And she usually has a little bit of a cooler head. But the second Guy Goddard shows up at her apartment, she's just like, whoa, hot man.
Yeah.
And it's kind of reduced to... not much, which is very sad.
Yeah, it seems to intimate that her type is middleman, which is odd, and seems like in some ways it's just, that part is just to add fuel to the fire of the Lacey-middleman relationship.
Maybe. I also wonder, because the episode we're going to talk about after this one, she does have her sort of fantasy about Pip from the sublet, the illegal sublet, which maybe suggests to me that maybe some aspect of this is also a power dynamic. And I don't think it's explored very well, but because Pip is also in a position of a power we learned earlier in the season, right? He basically lords over this place. So I don't know if that's exactly what is going on or if that's maybe something, there may be something more going on there, but, it does seem, and I agree with you, both of you, that it's it kind of undermines her character a little bit for me, because I understand her romantic interest in the middleman. There's this kind of mutual respect there, but that seems to kind of go away when Kevin Sorbo shows up and just wonders what she's wearing for her cologne, and it's like turpentine and fake blood, and like that's all that needs to happen. It just feels very much, I don't know, it feels out of place a little bit.
Yeah, even though her response to that question is great, because he says, what is the delightful scent on your skin? And she's like, it's turpentine, mixed paints, fake blood, and sweat. And he's like, it's delightful, or it's heaven.
I'll call it heaven.
which is kind of a hilarious exchange, except that even if it is an interesting idea to say that her type is middleman, and that's what's going on there, but at the point that that happens, she has no way of even knowing that he is a middleman.
Yeah.
And he doesn't present any way like Wendy's boss.
Right. There's
he just sort of like shows up and he's a stranger that she doesn't know. And he like grabs her hand and starts kissing it, which is the Lacey that we've been presented in other episodes, I would just assume would not stand for that.
Yeah. Cause I think there may be a narrative economy question where he shows up and Ida is charmed because they had a previous working relationship.
Yeah, and that makes sense.
Wendy is the exact opposite. And then there aren't other women that he interacts with until after the scene with Lacey. So I could also see it used inexpertly this is a way to make it very clear how charming somebody who isn't instantly repulsed finds him. But again, I think it undermines Lacey based on what we've seen before.
I feel like part of the problem I'm having there is that, and they lay his character on so thick, I feel like he's being so aggressive that the aggressiveness is what's the problem there. If he were not as aggressive, I could see how Lacey might find him attractive. But he's really pretty rapey, which is just not cool.
He's overbearing.
And I can't imagine Lacey, as we have seen her in other episodes, thinking, hey, a stranger's just like forced his way into my apartment and trying to kiss me now. As cool.
Yeah, and I feel like that is something that would make more sense if some of the dream sequence elements from the episode that comes after this was established well before, because then it would do what I was thinking is possibly there's like a power dynamic element and it would kind of set that up. I mean, you'd have to do some more, it'd have to be more clearly woven into her character, but it feels like it comes kind of out of left field. And I do feel like the last four episodes, more so than some of the others, occasionally seem to take shortcuts to get to narrative tension. And I don't know why, but I mean, there are a couple episodes. There's one moment when Ida gets taken over by nanobots and they like drop the Hadar on her head. And then in the next scene, they're running down the hall and all of a sudden Ida's there again. And it just, there's no real, like, how did we get from the Hadar, she's stuck in the Hadar, to suddenly she's in the hall chasing after them again. It just, there are some scenes where I think that there's clearly like a shortcut being taken. We need to get to this tension, but we don't have the time or the space to necessarily bring it out. And this seems like one of them. Like, they wanted this scene in particular to serve the purpose for the kind of revealing character, but it's not set up by anything prior to kind of lead us to think that this is a possibility. So I mean, some of it could be like what you said, Mike, right? Like the idea of like narrative economy and whatnot. But otherwise, like, the episode is a lot of fun, I think.
And I do like how... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. The episode is a lot of fun, and we haven't even talked about some of the really fun stuff that happens. Like, the melting thing is kind of a thing all the way through, and there's some great visual gags involving ice cream and other things like that.
Yeah, and I love how the Middleman 69 has, like, the analog way of doing things that... current middleman with his weapons and gadgets and things is like, get on the Hadar and the OCD, and he's like, we're gonna put an ad
in the thrifty nickel.
Yeah, and there's like Balthorium G and all of the indulgently silly stuff of that genre that it jumps into and really, I think, pretty expertly weaves between loving parody and just loving.
Yeah, I agree. I also really liked the way that when they catch the candle through the thrifty nickel...
quote-unquote, catch the candle.
it turns out to be a kid who's actually been friends with the candle, who is now dead. And the whole thing that he reveals is that, like, basically the candle ended up not being evil for the rest of his life.
Because he found Jesus.
Right, well, but like... The thing that I think is really interesting about that is that, like, he's basically saying, look, all the stuff that you did and who you are, middleman of 69, is obsolete. The villains that you're fighting against don't exist, and the way that you do things isn't actually valid anymore. And in some ways, that's kind of sad, and in other ways, it's kind of like, that's actually kind of refreshing, because the way that you do things is not always so great.
Yeah, and that each era creates its middleman, and
that
middleman is the one who's equipped to face threats of that era.
Yeah, and that's the one of the things I like about the last few episodes is that we do see different variations on the middleman. So this is one of them, but there also is another one coming.
Yeah, there is definitely another one coming. Yeah, and you know, and I think a lot of that, right, this idea of this middleman being obsolete, I think the episode's sort of playing that up in the sense that when he kind of middleman 69 betrays contemporary middleman in the end, right, it's this act of desperation to kind of justify his existence when clearly he doesn't belong in the same way. I did feel that scene felt a little rushed in the sense that he then turns back to being hero and sacrifices himself to save contemporary middleman. But I could see the kind of narrative they're playing out, right? The sort of fallen good guy who must then discover what it is to be a good guy again and then sacrifices himself to save new good guy. It's a kind of commonly worn trope, but it is somewhat satisfying, I feel. So if there were more time to spend on it, but these episodes aren't 12 hours, so I guess it's kind of a lot to ask. They are kind of, I guess, taking a lot of narratives from these different types of stories and trying to sort of cram them into a specific space in order to kind of do parody or loving parody or like just straight up parody as was suggested before. So, yeah.
All right, shall we move on to the next one?
I think that's a good plan. And this one is, Julia, I believe you said that the vampiric puppet lamentation is yours.
Yes, I love this episode. It may be my favorite episode of the entire series. I'm not sure, but it might be.
Cool.
I love this episode partly because it's no secret. I've said it before. I love Noser. And we do get to see a little bit of Noser being cool in the last episode as well. But this episode in particular has a lot to do with Noser because he's missing for it. And there's a prophecy that young Noser will be rent limb from limb to save you, you being Wendy Watson. The plot is that there are puppets of Vlad the Impaler and his girlfriend that are vampiric evil things that want to take over other people through having been put on their arms and then bring upon an eternal night of blood, bring out an eternal night of blood upon the world by performing an evil marriage ceremony with the bodies of two humans who are in love with each other. All this time, Noser is missing and Wendy is really worried about him because she hasn't seen him. So she starts trying to look for him and ends up getting Lacey to start looking for him in her stead. Lacey is having sex dreams about Pip, which are really uncomfortable because Pip, as we've seen earlier, is a horrible person. And the middleman is also not so sanguine about this, because when he finds out, he's like, how can Lacey be with him? He's a plagiarist! Which is hilarious. But this basically takes a bunch of different things I love and throws them all together. And then, on top of all of that, Noser, it turns out, is a master ventriloquist. And so then we get to go to a ventriloquism competition where everybody is like, Noser, oh god, you didn't tell me he was here. Everything's ruined. He's going to win everything for sure. But it turns out, spoiler town, that his puppet, young Noser, is carved from finest Carpathian wood, which is the only thing that can kill vampires. And so young Noser is, in fact, rent limb from limb to save Dub-Dub and the rest of the team. But not before middleman and Lacey get married in the evil ceremony, which is a very poignant thing. Like, this whole episode does a really great job of mixing lots of very funny things with lots of super kind of bittersweet things, because Lacey and the middleman have not talked about their feelings to anyone. But when the vampire puppets need to find two people who are in love, they immediately go to those two people. And Wendy is like, but that must mean, and the middleman is just sort of like, I don't want to talk about it. And then after it happens, Wendy tries to talk him into going with Lacey and actually sort of like in the Titanic episode, he was like, that's really not safe and it's not going to happen. But in this episode, she's like, you should just do it anyway. And he says that there was nothing that would actually stop him from being with her if that was what he really wanted. But she's not the only woman he loves, so it wouldn't necessarily be fair. And that's just kind of like a horrible, sad ending to the whole Lacey middleman dynamic. But really well for now, yes. Also, young Noser, though. And Noser in general. I love Noser.
Although, to be honest, I really wish we had seen more of his routine.
Yeah, but that's the joke about Noser. You never actually get to see what Noser does. You just know he's a genius. Like, Stump the Band with Noser is always, do you know this song? And he says,
Yeah, I know it. And then, like, when you hear from everyone that he's this master ventriloquist, but then when you start to get to see his material, which Pip has secretly recorded and plans to release to myfaceinatube.com, he starts to show it, and we just get to see the bare beginning where Noser asks young Noser what happened to his arms. But before anything happens after that, Lacey steals the camera and gets the footage away from him.
It is, right? It keeps heightening the mystery. We keep learning things he does, but we never see him do the things.
Which is how you know he's, like, amazing, because everybody knows he's actually truly amazing.
Yeah, so Noser's awesomeness is like the kind of the glow of the box in Pulp Fiction.
That
by withholding it, we make it more, we invest more in it. And I love that, like, he has the kind of the world-class Eastern European tutor who comes and trains him, and then she kind of waxes eloquently about how amazing he is. And it's not like that he's a musician or that he's a vampire hunter. It's, you know, ventriloquism, which, you know, is another style of art, but it's not one that tends to get respect or thought about or framed narratively in the same way, which then that juxtaposition makes it even more funny for a lot of people.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also just love the way they deal with all of the different vampire stereotypes. This is, the Urtext here is every vampire piece of literature or movie that you've ever seen. And, of course, there are all the requisite references, like there is a minor character named Rehnquist who is in an asylum after having had a run-in with Vladdy, the puppet, before. And there are some other various things that come up. But my favorite vampire thing is that Wendy Watson has watched all the vampire movies. She knows all of this stuff, but for some reason the middleman still wants to drill her on vampire basics. And so he has this book of vampire facts, and he's there in the car, and he's reading questions that are like, you know, can vampires be detected by mirrors? And she's just rolling her eyes. But my favorite is, if a vampire offers you soup, what does this mean?
Yeah. Do they ever answer that? I can't remember. I don't think
so. No, they never answer that. It's just left for as an exercise to the reader.
I kept thinking the second he said that is what I thought was the Tyler with the gazpacho. And I was like, oh my god, he's a vampire.
Yeah. Oh no!
Because that was immediately where my head went. I just, yeah. But no, that's not how the story went.
I like that with the middleman being sidelined by the kind of the vampire attack and possession, we see Wendy kind of being the junior middleman and kicking a lot of butt. You know, she tears through the vampire puppet minions. She's the one who's looking after the middleman. She kind of gathers the troops and puts the plot together. So over the course of the 12-episode season, we've seen her coming into her own more and more, not just being competent, but being competent as a middleman.
Yeah, and she really does get a chance to shine on her own in this one and save the day, which is really great. Like, she says at one point, I'm going to get my Buffy on. And the middleman tells her that the middlemen have killed more vampires than anyone ever. And she's like, how many is that? And he says, 2. but by the end of the episode, sure enough, she does, in fact, kill 2 vampire puppets with crossbow gun
guns things. With the little arms from Little Noser
Little Noser's arms have been made into stakes to kill the vampire puppets, and she gets to shoot them, and she does totally save the day. One of the other things I love about this episode, though, is that because there is so much done with puppets, you have a lot of really interesting puppet acting going on, and lots of people pretending to be completely catatonic while the puppets are doing the acting. And they're like the whole evil wedding ceremony between the middleman and Lacey. They're the two human actors there are basically completely checked out and just have this glazed over stare going on. And the puppets are doing the acting, which is really interesting. And it's always exciting when something like that actually works well, because little Vladdy is a great puppet. Like every time he wakes up, he's like, where am I?
Who are you? What am I doing here?
Who are you people?
Why are you laughing at me? I will kill you.
Yeah.
Which, like, this means that anytime I or Moss wakes up from a dead sleep and is startled, we're just sort of like, where am I? Who are you people?
That puppet's so creepy, though.
I love how committed to the ridiculousness this episode takes the show and the characters, where the middleman, like, draws a face onto yes. his hand so that he can interrogate Renfield, and then, Rehnquist won't respond to Wendy unless she kind of fake ventriloquists. So they're always taking a thing, you know, a trope or a meme, and they're pushing it at least one step farther towards something funny, which is just really cool.
Well, the perfect example of that too is the scene where we're supposed to get the bloodbath, right? They find this tape from this old talk show host, and here is this guy who won't put on the puppet because he's afraid. It's Renfield, right? He's terrified of the puppet. He's like, it's so delicate. I can't. And he puts it on, and it becomes a guy, and all of a sudden, this puppet is like eating, like biting all of these people, but it's a puppet on a guy's arm. Right, so it's like this guy being drug around while this puppet's like sucking the blood off people in what is just this really gruesome scene. I mean, it's not like actually graphically gruesome, but the implication is just super gruesome, but yet it's so patently absurd that there's this.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really good example of what I was saying before about this episode is really good about being both really ridiculously over the top funny and also not being afraid to shy away or to embrace like the sadness and the horror, because when that happens, it's like, it's kind of funny on one level, but on another level, it's really horrifying. And Wendy is just horrified, and she's telling Ida, you know, turn it off. We don't need to be seeing this. Because when you realize that this guy who was afraid to put the puppet on, put it on, and then was possessed by a vampire and eventually lost his arm because the vampire ate a bunch of people and this happened on live television, and she's watching people get eaten, that's actually really horrifying if you think about it. And it's sad when you meet the guy and you're like, this is what happened to him. But I think the episode does a really good job of sort of like embracing both the ridiculous and the horror/sadness.
Yeah. I agree.
It's the other really ridiculous, over-the-top one is the first, the auctioneer, because they're auctioning off all of Vlad the Impaler's stuff, which includes his puppet, apparently. And the auctioneer is the first one to put the puppet on in modern day. And when he does, little Vladdy wakes up and, you know, he says, where am I? Who are your people? Threatens the audience and then runs out to find his true love. And as Wendy and the middleman are chasing him... He turns into a vampire bat puppet and flies away.
It's ridiculous. And of course, that's their response, right? Did he just turn into a bat puppet? Yes, he did.
And I think there's so much that the show does that you really need a visual medium to be able to get away with. The types of comedy that it deploys and the way that it uses that juxtaposition of, like, the tragic and the funny and the different ways that those elements come together. I would have the hardest time imagining how a concept like this could actually play out in prose, which is something I kind of struggle with as a writer, because things like this are such a big influence on me. Like, how do you recapture some of those things? And it does seem like some versions of comedy and some types of storytelling work far better in a medium like this, where you can have that juxtaposition.
Yeah, I think it's a very hard thing to pull off in any medium, really. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I appreciate the episode so much, is that good comedic material is so hard to pull off. And what makes a lot of it work is the edge underneath. And this doesn't lose the edge all the way through. Because there's also the subplot with Lacey and Pip, is that Pip is a horrible person. And he is scoffing at everybody, including Lacey, for trying to be nice to people. And she keeps telling him, you know, maybe if you were nice to people, they'd actually give you things that you wanted or be nice to you back. And he kind of sort of comes around in some places around on that, to the point where you can almost feel sorry for him, but he's still kind of a horrible person. And in the end, Lacey ends up basically betraying him, which is really warranted and satisfying on one level, and also kind of sad because it means it's perpetuating the cycle. Like, if there was ever any hope for Pip, it's just not going to happen.
In an imaginary second or third season, I could see him coming around like a Cordelia character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's also because I think a lot of that is this episode is more about Lacey working through her stuff than it is really about Pip. We get a little bit of sort of Pip realizing that maybe everybody hates him for good reason, but it's always really about Lacey kind of working through her things, even as she's telling Wendy, right? Like, you know, that's not what's going on, but that's obviously what's happening, is she's trying to work through this fact that she's had a wild sex dream about him. And yeah, so it's expected that she's going to betray him in the end, but it is kind of also a little bit sad because Pip could be a character that could really be on their side, but instead he's going to kind of be that character who's always kind of on the outside, that nobody likes, but is in a position of power, and so is kind of forced to be into their lives. So.
Well, yeah, the other thing that we haven't really talked about that sex dream is that, so the last time we saw the middleman and Lacey in the Titanic episode, he basically told her, you know, gotta ride lonesome, and it's not going to happen. And she walked away from that, but she's still obviously actually working through that, and that's a lot of what's going on in this episode. It's not... The sex dream about Pip, it's interesting to note, starts out, quote, normally, which she doesn't explain to Dub-Dub what that means, but we see it, and that's the middleman walking in the door and saying, hello, Lacey. And then, like, he steps forward, and she realizes it's Pip, and that's kind of, like, horrifying, but she finds it hot because it's still in the trappings of the middleman. And I read that not as, like, she's actually really attracted to Pip so much as... she's trying to process that she cannot have him. She cannot have the middleman. And so, like, your subconscious does weird things to you and makes uncomfortable things happen when you're trying to process something like that. So it's like, you know, here, hello, Lacey. Oh, by the way, this is the person you actually hate more than anyone else.
Sort of a coping mechanism, right?
And then sort of she's like, well, what's going on? Why am I feeling this way about Pip? But she's not really feeling that way about Pip. Pip still repulses her. It's really that she feels that way about the middleman, and she knows she can't have him, and she ends up at the end of things not remembering the evil marriage ceremony, of course, and Wendy knows that she can't be with the middleman, and she says to the middleman, ride lonesome, and he says yes, and stuff, but, like, she doesn't remember any of that happening, but Wendy knows it did. And at the very end, we find out that she's had another sex dream, but this time it is the normal one, which is just the middleman. And she's sort of happy about that, but that's, again, another really bittersweet moment, because we know that the middleman has told Wendy that he loves someone else. So there's more than just the danger going on to separate them.
It's sad. Because they're so cute together, darn it! Well, any case, shall we move on to the third episode?
I've apparently silenced everyone.
Yeah.
No, that's all great. I really like what you had to say.
Yeah, it was a good point. Yeah.
So should we move on to the next episode?
I think so. And this would be the only one I'd describe. Because
it's like Die Hard in a building.
Yes.
It's like Die Hard in a building.
It's like Fantastic Voyage.
Die Hard is in a building.
It's like Fantastic Voyage.
Is Sean still here?
I'm sorry, I've been, like, talking the whole time, and my mic has been muted. Because okay. I'm a dumbass.
Okay, did you have any last vampiric thoughts before we move on?
No, all I said was that I thought that you said something good, and only it was more articulate than what I just actually said. Only no one heard me. So, but yes, we should move on to the next episode, which is the one I get to describe, because Mike gets to do the last one.
All right, go for it.
So, as you all were saying, right, it is like Fantastic Voyage or Die Hard, which I found really amusing. Some of the title slots that come up in this episode are rather fun. But this episode's called The Clotharian Contamination Protocol. And the basic premise is that one of the Voyager probes is discovered to be careening off back to Earth and crash lands on Earth and... Apparently, that can only result in, it could be the result of a number of possible things. One being that it could be infected with an alien virus come to destroy the planet. It could become with an actual alien entity inside, presumably also to destroy the planet. Or it could have gotten sentience and is coming back to meet its makers, a la Star Trek. And I think there was a fourth option, but I can't remember what the
fourth
option
was. Or it could have come back to judge its makers and has done so and has found us wanting.
I'm sorry, I didn't get anything you just said.
The number four is number three, but it has already judged us and found us wanting.
Oh, right, gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, so all of the options of it returning are not good, basically. And so they bring it back to the Weehawken... Oh, God.
Jolly Fats Weehawken Temporary Employment
Agency. Thank you. Jolly Fats Weehawken Temporary Employment Agency. And, of course, it does have nanobots in it, and it's all kinds of bad news. And so Ida gets infected, and the nanobots are basically set there by the Clotharian government to destroy us because, as it turns out, when we send our probes out into the universe, sometimes they take pictures of things they're not supposed to, as happened with Voyager, which fell into a black hole and then managed to take pictures of a secret Clotharian facility and was sending pictures back. And as punishment... for not only getting pictures of secret Clotharian facilities, but also sending reality TV into space, the Clotharians have decided that Earth needs to have its entire technological makeup destroyed so that we are reduced basically to cavemen again. And thus, the episode follows as Dubby and our joyful middleman have to thwart the nanobots basically by doing... the Fantastic Voyage inside Ida's head. Yeah. That's basically it. We also get a reveal which is unrevealed, which is that the middleman learns that there is a pneumatic tube that leads to the oh God, is it CH? I can't remember.
O2STK.
Thank you. O2STK.
Organization. Too secret to know.
Too secret to know. Yes. Which leads back, and that's where they send Ida's body. In order to get it decontaminated. But unfortunately, when he goes back in, the pneumatic tube is gone, and thus the organization remains too secret for us to know anything about, because anything that was revealed is proved to be basically not null and void. So there you go. So it's a fun little episode. It's got aliens in it in a very funny hat.
And the one of the side plots, if I'm recalling correctly, is... Tyler Ford interviewing for a job with manservant Neville.
Right, played by Mark Shepard.
Yes.
Yep.
The amazing Mark Shepard, who is one of a number of SF actors who it seems like all of science fiction television decides that they need to hire this actor. And because it's Mark Shepard, I totally get it.
He's in everything. yeah, because he plays basically, I guess... some version of, like, Steve Jobs meets the guy from The Aviator.
Yeah.
Because he's the super eccentric, but then he runs Tyler through a bunch of, like, crazy tests. These bizarre
which
tests.
Which are bizarrely similar to the middleman tests.
True, which also made me question a lot whether or not, somehow, the secret organization is actually Fat Boy, the company run by Mark Shepard's character. Although that is never revealed in this episode, and having not read the comics, I don't know if it's ever revealed, but I started to think and started putting connections together, man. I think it's true.
And another thing with this one is the Code 47, which is revealed to be the message that the middleman records on each mission to leave for Wendy, should he perish. And we get a lot of callbacks to earlier stories. And it also makes Wendy face the possibility of her own mortality, that she might not make it out of being a middleman or a middleman in training.
Yeah, and she's very reluctant, right? She doesn't want to make this video and she or this thing. And she does at the very end when she kind of has no choice, which is really... it's really heartwarming, that moment, right? Because she's kind of... she basically says, like, a middleman, you're like the father that I've lost. And it's, you know, there's a little bit of tears, and it's really kind of beautiful. And then, of course, she surrounds herself by nanobots and blows up Ida's head and somehow miraculously survives. But, you know.
It's because nanobots are indestructible.
Well, yes, this is true. They also look like something out of a children's show reject robot. And I did find it amusing that when they came out, what they proceeded to do was basically to poke any technology in the room, because they're designed, as the middleman tells us, right, to deconstruct our technology from the inside, not from the outside in. So they're just basically, like, poking, like, the table and any computers, and they look like little children who are just totally confused and don't know what to do. And I love the implication, which is that we're just going to, like, stick them in, like, a giant bubble, like, and they'll be happy in there.
Yeah, like, we'll, like, just build them a little nanobot farm, like an ant farm.
Yeah, like an ant farm. It's funny.
But yeah, I love all of the diehard references in this one, because it does do the Fantastic Voyage thing, but it really does call back to Die Hard a few different times. And one of them is when the middleman and Wendy are crawling through the vents. And they then explain how the vents, like, they explain away how the vents are not actually a bad thing. That, like, if the building is completely sealed, why are the vents open? And it's like, oh, well, because of the Nakatomi Protocol, the vents have expanded. So they're only there when needed in this particular emergency situation. But she also gets to say, ho, 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 I have a machine gun, ho, 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 which is the best line in Die Hard.
And come out to the coast, we'll have a few laughs.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so lots of references.
My only regret is that she doesn't lose her shoes and have to, like, wrap up her feet and be badass that way, or strap something to her back.
Yeah, that would be excellent. The other thing that's really interesting in this is that she goes into Ida's head, and she's supposed to press the reset button in Ida's brain, but the nanobots have deactivated that, so she ends up having to work with Ida to come up with a way to defeat the nanobots otherwise. And the interesting thing there was that the Ida that we see in Ida's brain is sort of like the deep, softer, true part of Ida. And she's a lot more gentle and soft in her, both in her looks and in the way she treats Wendy. And it sort of, like, shows a little bit of how much Ida actually cares about Wendy.
I kind of thought, too, that that particular scene when she goes into that big white room, it was like the Matrix, taking the architect and, like, mixing her with the Oracle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The kind of was what that felt like, and I don't know if that was into the intent, but it certainly seemed like that's what they're calling back to there, which is kind of fun,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, she should have offered her a cookie.
Yeah, that would have been fun, right? And then said, like, I already know whether you're going to take it. You know? Yeah.
Or a brownie. And then she can make a stoner joke.
Because there's so many.
I already knew you were going to take it. You're always on the hippie lettuce.
You're on the hippie lettuce. I love the, like, phrases she comes up with. The hippie lettuce. Ah, it's so brilliant. I love all of the pot references. There should be a compilation of all of the various terms that anyone in the show uses to refer to pot.
Ida Supercut?
Yeah. Because she uses, I think, like, just in these four episodes, like, five or six different versions. Yeah, hippie lettuce. It's the other one. The one
demon weed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Something. I think she says hippie leaf at one point, and yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. So the other thing that's really interesting in comparison to the episode with 69 Middleman is that in this episode we see that the Middleman and Wendy both have been contaminated by alien stuff, and they're going to have to scrub each other down, which is somewhat awkward for both of them, but the middleman is, like, basically like, we have to do this, so just, like, strip your clothes off. And we see Wendy, like, walking around in her bra and underwear for an extended period of time, but it is absolutely not objectified. And I really appreciated that, and especially in contrast to the episode before last, when it was, like, all about the 69 middleman wanting her to be in, you know, cat suits and bikinis and all that stuff, and very much objectifying her. We get to see, like, how sometimes it's actually necessary that you take off all your clothes in a work setting, and this is not actually something we need to objectify.
Yeah, and that's reinforced because I can't remember which, he's probably said it a couple times, but one of the episodes we watched for this, he says, like, he basically views her as a sister. Oh, it's when Ida is being the voyeur and, like, following the quote-unquote protocols and in a super creepy way watching her have sex with Tyler. And his response immediately when he comes in is like, Ida, that's disgusting. And he, like, turns it off. you know, because it's basically like watching a sister. So there's that very clear sense when we get to that scene that for him, it's never going to be sexualized, right? This is just like, we have to do this. It's the end of the discussion. Like, we're going to die if we don't.
And like, not only does he consider her like a sister, but I also had the impression that he would not be watching any of his partners, no matter who they were, and even if he was attracted to them, because that's just not ethical. And he's very ethical.
That's true. Yeah.
And a deep reference in that episode is the middleman exclamation that he utters when he first sees it is story of O.
Oh. Yes.
Which, like, I admit I only vaguely knew the first time through, but like in further viewings, as I realized that those sayings really meant something, that was kind of a height of, it's not a geek reference. It's just like a deep pop culture reference.
Interesting. Huh.
That's how I would frame it. I don't know. Shall we move on to the palindrome versus palindrome?
The last one? Are you going to be able to do it without crying, Mike?
I don't know, man. No, because there's still comics, and I get to rewatch them forever.
Fair enough.
So in the palindrome reversal palindrome, our heroes discover a set of clues, which then the middleman bangs his head on and is trying to figure out, and they go back and forth and discover that it's in fact that these little pieces are suggesting a man, a plan, a canal, Panama, and therefore it's the palindrome, and they're looking for something with palindromes, and they come across a gentleman, Ivan Avi, who has a double, Ivan Avi, in another world, and Wendy gets accidentally transported to a mirror universe, which they reference the Star Trek episode where everyone has goatees. And in this mirror universe, which is a dystopian world ruled by Fatboy Industries, in fact, pretty much everyone has a goatee, or all the male identifying characters have goatees. And people who are evil are good, and people who are good were evil. And Wendy runs around trying to escape dystopian ridiculousness, and goes to find the middleman, who is channeling Snake Plissken in Escape from New York with a mullet and an eye patch, and has become a mercenary. And Ida in this universe is just as snarky, but in a different way, and with a much more conventionally attractive chassis instead of the domineering schoolmarm chassis. And Wendy tries to enlist his help, and he's a mercenary, and it goes back and forth, and she goes back to Lacey, who turns out the art school that they went to together, Wendy disappeared in this world and left Lacey behind in the school that had been turned into a fat boy management, management academy. So Wendy betrayed Lacey in this world, so she has to repair that relationship. And Tyler in this world was the middle boy and was killed by, dun-dun-dun, not Manservant Neville, but the true power behind the throne, which is, in fact, Wendy Watson of that universe. So we get evil doubles, we get good doubles of evil people and evil doubles of good people, we get dystopian references galore, we get the middleman trying his darndest to help from the other dimension, and we see a strong juxtaposition between our middleman that we know and the kind of darkest timeline middleman who, you know, will torture people and thinks that he's really callous and professes not caring about how people, you know, what people think of him and that he's a loner and so on and so forth. So it's a deconstruction of that dystopian hero by contrast, referring back to the middleman that we know and love. And I think it's a really fitting series finale, and I think that by that time they kind of knew a fair bit that the writing was on the wall, so they did a fair amount of the denouement, so we see that fairly solid end notes for a lot of the relationships, and then the stuff that happens in the comics just kind of resolves some of the other loose ends.
Yeah,
and there are a lot of palindromes.
I love a lot of things about this episode. But one of the things that I think it does a lot is it calls into question everything, because in this mirror universe, Wendy Watson is like the ultimate evil. And Manservant Neville, I'm not saying his name correctly, is ominously maybe not so evil? question mark? Which makes you wonder. that there are also some really good things going on with character developments with, for instance, in this one, Lacey and the middleman actually get a happy ending. So they get to ride off together into the sunset on the middle hog. Well, if they get it back from the Fat Boy Industries. And they start to clean up the world and act as a team together, but they like actually are together, which is nice. We also see a lot of Wendy worrying about her relationship with Tyler and whether he's going to turn into someone who is consumed by his job and gives her expensive jewelry instead of, you know, actually spending time with her. And Lacey and Noser have hearts to hearts with her where they talk about, you know, the fact that she also has gone away and that Lacey is no longer puts as many eggs in her Wendy basket and manages her expectations, but there's still actually a solid relationship there. And so there's a lot of clearly wrapping up things in sort of nicely resolved ways that goes on in this episode.
Yeah, and you know, the references too are I found really, really exciting for this one because, you know, there's obviously the Big Brother sort of overarching reference going on here, but I also saw Equilibrium being played out, which I don't know if how many of you have seen Equilibrium.
Yeah, I...
Did you not see it? There's so much. There's so much Equilibrium.
There's also the Terminator.
Terminator.
Come with me if you want to live.
There's like a direct reference. Yeah, Terminator, Escape from New York.
There's lots of stuff around Escape from New York and LA and stuff.
Yeah.
But he lives at 1997 Pliskin Circle or Pliskin Drive or whatever.
Yeah.
And he looks exactly like Snake Plissken.
And talks like him.
Mm-hmm. Which is also great because that's actually the same actor who plays the middleman in the modern
Kiesler. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's great to see, like, at one point Wendy calls it, like, how can you be in the same skin as my boss and be this horrible?
Yeah. Well, and the other big touchstone I see is the Star Trek Mirror Mirror and the Mirror Universe stories because you have the goatees and she invokes it directly. Wendy, I believe, invokes that.
You mean
invokes
the 1960s TV series starring George Takei?
That was amazing. And we have Pip as a good guy because he's Father Pip.
A man of the cloth.
Helping people escape from the Fat Boy regime. Which is amazing.
Oh, and there's
and this, you have Noser, which is really unsettling because, like, she gets to her building and she sees Noser and she's like, okay, we're home free, it's cool. And then Noser's like, who's the man? And she's like, Noser, thank God, you know, you don't really have time. And he's like, pulls out this giant gun and is like, who's the man? And she's like, Shaft. And then he keeps being very menacing with his gun until she answers all the questions regarding Shaft.
Right, following the same pattern, right?
That we've and it seen turns before. Out that he's basically Lacey's enforcer, and Lacey runs a strip club.
Which happens to be helpful, since someone who's high up in security at Fat Boy likes the ladies, apparently.
Oh, Joe 90.
Apparently a more successful lawyer in this universe.
Yep.
True. Yeah, that's just I found it a really fun episode because of all of the references. I mean, just the Plissken bit where he's just playing, he's just Snake Plissken. That's so much fun to see Kiesler getting to be, you know, not just the kind of up and up, you know, Dudley Do Right kind of figure, but also getting to be this sort of snarling, like amoral mercenary anti-hero. It's just a lot of fun to see that happen, to get them to kind of play different roles. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's always fun to see people stretching outside of their normal bounds, which we also get to see in the Panhellenic investigation. I'm mixing that one up. But the ghost sorority one, where he ends up being possessed by the sorority girl and such. But I always like to see actors stretching.
Yeah, and we get Natalie Morales playing kind of evil Wendy, and the way that Wendy's intelligence and resourcefulness could have gone a very different direction.
Yeah, and she's the great thing about Evil Wendy and also Mirror Universe Ida is that both of them clearly are the same person in certain respects, but also different. Like the way that you said that Ida is snarky, but in a kind of different way, but it's still very clear that she's Ida. And Evil Wendy is like, there's a point where Lacey and Good Wendy are like, oh, you can't kill us. We're your best friend and your alternate you. And she's like, oh, you're right. I can't do this. And they're like, really? Psych. And you're like, I can really see Wendy saying that. But also, I can't see Wendy saying that.
Yeah. Yeah, she's evil. Because she's like keeping Mark Shepard like cryogenically frozen in a room.
Yeah, because he really wants to return the power to the people.
Right, and she, I guess, brings him out once in a while and forces him to make speeches? I mean,
that's not super clear, because he hasn't been seen for a while, I think they say.
Right.
Yeah, but when she talks to him, he recognizes her and says, haven't you done enough to me? So it's clear that, like, he's conscious of where he is and who she is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I really like that the big bad in the mirror universe is not the middleman evil, it's herself.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, it's the same mythic resonance stuff as Empire Strikes Back, like failure in the cave, you must face only what you bring with yourself kind of stuff.
Right, your own demons, essentially.
Yeah, and she's also coming to grips with, like, the mirror universe, Wendy is the one that killed Tyler. So she's coming to grips with her relationship to Tyler, which was already something she was processing.
Right, because yeah, she thinks her superpower, right, is being able to see into the future of her relationships and knowing how they will end.
Right, well, plus there's also the question of whether Tyler's going to turn into someone who's consumed by work and whether she has let down her friends, which has been a kind of steady thread throughout the series of her not necessarily always being there for Lacey and Lacey having learned not to put all of her eggs in a Wendy basket. And then when she goes to the opposite world, she sees just how badly Wendy betrayed Lacey and just how much Lacey cannot trust or forgive that Wendy. And it's a very sort of like, oh, you have to right that wrong and you have to realize what you have the power to do, how you have the power to mess things up and how you have the power to not mess things up. And she ends up redeeming that middleman. She doesn't just, like, he ends up coming in to save her, but it's because she's helped redeem him and helping him to figure out how to take down the evil her.
Yeah, and there's even that great moment, right, where she pulls out the bracelet that Tyler gave her, and I can't remember when it is that he sneaks it into her pocket or something, right? Because originally he was going to take it as payment, and I think that's kind of reinforcing that idea that he has, in fact, not only been redeemed, but that he's sort of found his old path again of the middleman. He's just going to be the Snake Plissken middleman. He's going to be gruff and have an eye patch. Yeah. Which Sensei Ping took, so.
Yeah, although in this world he pushed Sensei Ping.
Yes. Not a...
Betrayal!
Betrayal! Not always good. Yeah.
Super betrayal.
Yeah.
Yeah, also we see in this episode and in the 69 Middleman episode, Ida being willing to go to a point far with the, like, snarkiness and the being interested in sort of, like, the bad middleman ways. But in both episodes, there comes a point when Ida reaches her limit on ethical stuff and says, like, yeah, no, you're actually evil, and I'm not going to let that happen. And I'm going to side more with the good middleman. In the 69 one, it's when she actually subdues 69 middleman instead of letting him take over the organization. And in the Snake Plissken one, it's when she sort of says, like, you know what, I'm going to quit now instead of just letting you be mercenary forever because not even this world deserves a middleman like you.
Yeah. Yeah, the one that happens in this, though, feels much more pointed because it's very much kind of an indictment of who he has become. Because this new Wendy, right, like, why should he listen to her? She's from a parallel universe. She's not, she's not anyone, but Ida, who's stuck behind him all this time, walking away, I think is kind of one of those last, that like the last straw kind of being pulled out from underneath him, as it were.
So. Yeah, well, it's also a pretty pivotal point in the other episode, too, because she has been super excited to have him back. And she even says, like, he was my boss first. I'm going to go with his idea and all of that stuff. But then when it becomes clear that 69 Middleman is actually doing bad stuff, not good stuff, she says, actually, no, like, I'm going to stop you.
Yeah, despite all of that snark, right, there is, as we learned, there's that really good Ida in the middle. So,
yeah. Though I have to give a shout out back to episode 11, where when Ida is in kind of Terminator / slasher movie mode, slasher monster mode, she has the best line, "Kiss my Asimov." When people are like, "How can you hurt us?" And she does the callback there, which I thought was lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I also like when, that's, I think the line is, he's like, you're not allowed to hurt me. And she's like, okay, miss, you can shove that up your Asimov.
Oh, references. I love that. Yeah. In fact, I do enjoy how they handle cursing in this. They either find clever ways to basically say the curse word while using it as a reference, or they bleep it out. To the point where they put that little black box over their mouth, yep. And everything, which is really fun.
Yeah, and they
is
do
it episode 11 where the middleman is doing a lot of what Wendy calls really gutter mouth talking?
I can't remember.
I think it's episode 11.
Well, because the Dark World middleman has a worse potty mouth than Wendy, and then she
no,
kind
no,
of
no, no.
The
I'm talking about the good middleman in. I think it's in the contamination one. She keeps telling him, like, what's up with all the gutter talk today? And that the funny thing is that what he's saying isn't actually bad. Like, they don't bleep it out. It's not, like, cuss words or anything like that. But then, like, if you think about what he's saying, it's a lot worse than what he usually says.
Right. Well, like, is that where when he says the devil's wedding tackle?
Yes, yes. And there are a bunch of other things that he says during that, too. I can't remember what they all are. But, like, if you stop to think about them, you're like, actually, he is kind of talking about raunchy stuff. Like, in complete euphemisms, but, like, well.
Well, the Middle Fortress has been compromised.
Exactly. Exactly. We also get to see him in that episode go really hardcore when he pretends to be from NASA to the actual NASA people who show up.
I want a whole show that's just that NASA character, like, being super hardcore.
How many retrievals have you been on?
If you want to write a letter to my boss, you can address it to current occupant 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
It is fun. It is pretty great. He just totally hands it back to him. I love that scene. That's a great scene. We should reenact it.
I think that might be going a bit far. Okay, so have we basically summed up all of the things that we love about the middleman?
I mean, we're pretty much, that's it, you know? We're at the end.
But I will remind folks again to check out the comic books of the Doomsday Armageddon Apocalypse and the Pan-Universal Parental Reconciliation, I believe is the quote-unquote episode 13. They're available as comics, and there were live, mostly full cast recordings of each, which are available on YouTube.
Yep, I will put them in the show notes.
Yay!
So people can see the quote-unquote lost episode and the episode that was made after that.
Woot!
So it should be really fun. Unfortunately, there's no more middleman.
Yeah, it's middleman I'm super lives sad on. that this series got canceled.
Yeah,
it's the kind of series that, like, today when I was. When I was rewatching stuff, I posted to Facebook the thing about vampires offering you soup with a screenshot, and two different friends saw it and were like, "What is this show? How come I've never heard of it?" And then immediately said, "I would love this." And I'm like, "Yes, you would." And this is the problem, like that not enough people realized it existed and watched it and made it a hit, which is very sad.
And it was a bit early for the wackier stuff on TV. Like it was either just before or started around the same time Community did, which I think Community does some of the same things that Middleman does, but when Community started, it was more reserved.
Right.
And even
well, and Community is more of a sitcom, which the Middleman is more trying, like it was more occupying an action drama comedy spot, which.
It's like funny X-Files.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
And it was originally on ABC Family, and the creator, Javier Grau, Mark Swatch, mentions that he knew that this was a weird fit and that he was going to be happy to take what he could get, is what I recall him saying, because it was on, and the show that it was either right before it or right after it was Secret Life of an American Teenager, so that just there was really not much of a lead-in, lead-out connection, and it was kind of an oddball show for that channel. And it was already on, like, cable.
Right.
And a not super, like, popular cable channel for the kind of audience that I think would most connect with it. I saw it somehow. I don't even remember how I got pegged to it. But watched from the beginning and loved it and was heartbroken but not surprised when it was canceled.
Yeah, see, whereas I was one of those people who found out about it right after it got canceled. So I didn't see it until it came out on DVD. But, like... I found out about it because fans of it were sad that it was getting canceled.
I just figured in your case, Mike, that your internal Hadar would just go off when something this geeky existed. You'd just be walking down the street one day and you'd hear a sound and you'd be like, oh my god, there's something super geeky going on. And then you would run like a flash and then you'd
right.
get in front
I'm
of
needed.
TV. Yeah. That's how your superpower works, right? It's activated by concentrations of geekiness.
Well, yeah, I feel pretty clear that the CW needs to pick up this show and make more episodes because the CW has been putting out a lot of really quality, goofy stuff.
It could work on something like CW. I mean, even something like sci-fi.
Yeah,
I mean,
the Flash.
No, I think the CW is a great place because it actually has a really wide viewership and it has some really oddball shows like Jane the Virgin, which is fantastic and completely bonkers. And I think that the audience who is drawn to that kind of show would really appreciate the Middleman.
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Kiesler has retired from acting. So, yeah, he...
I could see... No, go ahead.
Oh, he retired from acting. I believe he got a biology degree, and his reasoning was essentially that acting, I mean, while he liked it, he had a family, and it was unstable, and he basically needed a stable life for his family, and so he went to get a biology degree. So, he's written an essay on it. You can Google it. I'll try to remember to put it in the show notes. But yeah, so for him, it's kind of like he does maybe once in a while he'll do a special event for Middleman, like that crowdfunded episode 14. But otherwise, he's not really in the acting world at all anymore.
But I think the Middleman has made some impact on a variety of creators, myself certainly included. And hopefully when people listen to this, they will search it out, and maybe the legacy of the Middleman will live on.
It's definitely one you should have in your DVD library. I mean, I really think so. I think any super fan of science fiction fantasy stuff should have this one in their library.
It's definitely a good one to come to if you've had a really rough day, because it's always going to make you smile.
Yep. Yeah, that's true. It's a feel-good show, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
Cool. Well... That's it, guys. We did it.
Woohoo!
So, we have now gone through all 12 episodes of the original run of The Middleman. If you are listening and you want to leave your thoughts, you can obviously go to all of the website stuff, which will be at the end of the episode. And I don't know what we're going to do next, but we got other stuff to come up. So, thanks, Mike, I think it was you that basically said we need to do this. And then Julia was like, yes, I second everything Mike just said. And then... You guys sent things to my house until I said yes.
It's true. I did send Lucha Libre wrestlers and the Clan of the Pointed Stick to your house until you agreed.
Yeah.
But yes, thank you so much. This is really one of my like major TV touchstones and influence as a creator. So it's really cool to be able to share it with folks.
Yep. Excellent.
Whereas I sent you a U-Master and I'm surprised you haven't used that more.
I don't trust it.
It should have a subtle influence on your life.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't trust it. Don't trust it. He's evil. I know Fatboy's up to something. All right. Well, on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.